Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. Letter writing is a dying art, but fortunately there are some wonderfully creative souls around resurrecting old love letters and breathing life into them. One of them is Liz Maguire, the love letter collector, originally from Washington DC and now living in Dublin. From her first acquisition as a teenager of a set of vintage love letters from a flea market, Liz now holds a collection of over 1,600 letters. She told me that letters capture the essence of what it is to be living through history. In attics and drawers and shoeboxes under beds, there are hundreds of stories waiting to be told. Here we delve into her unique archive.
As I get older, you look back on things and you think like, wow, I was really into that series of books when I was a kid, or I was really into this, that, or the other. It took me a very long time to make the connection between the fact that my favorite film as a teenager was The Notebook. Like, I was obsessed with The Notebook. It was like,
oh, yeah. Oh.
40 viewings, director's commentary, like the whole thing. And then it was like the archive has been around for 5 years. And I would say it was probably in 2 or 3 years that I was like, that probably means something. Yeah. And I was obsessed with a film which the root of was lost letters.
there's a quick clue there. Talking of which, I thought of you yesterday because quite by chance I've put on Netflix and I just thought I really need something completely mind-numbing, and I came across Letters from Juliet. It's quite cheesy, but actually, you know, once she surrendered to it, it was quite nice, actually. It was like that woman who tracks down. Have you seen it?
It's a little brain massage, isn't it?
You're just It was just like slipping into a hot bath. I wasn't too taxing, but, you know, a woman reuniting an older woman with a letter that she wrote to her teenage sweetheart set in beautiful Tuscany. It's perfect. I think you'd love it.
Yeah, so it's funny you mentioned that because there's, have you ever heard of the organization, the Handwritten Letter Association?
No, I have not.
So it's run by a woman named Dinah Johnson, who you'll probably love too. Everyone who gets introduced to the Handwritten Letter Appreciation Society becomes just obsessed.
I mean, that's but amazing Dinah book title in itself, isn't it? The Handwritten Appreciation Society.
The Handwritten Letter app, soft, yeah. She, last year, I don't think she's done one yet this year, but she did a few movie nights last year. And one of them was, and by movie nights, I mean, she kind of picked a night, did a theme, posted some pictures about it and said like, you know, oh, everyone around the world who wants to watch this will watch it at 7:30 on Saturday. And Letters to Juliet was one. Guernsey Potato Peel Society was another.
Oh, I love it.
84 Charing Cross Road was one. Last Letter from Your Lover was another one that she did.
Okay. I haven't heard of that one. Guernsey Literary Potato Peel Pie. Now that I love. Loved the book.
Amazing.
Loved the film. Probably preferred the book. Did you like it?
Oh, yeah. The definition of an epistolary novel. Yeah. Whenever anyone says, you know, you and I got connected for your book and through kind of what I like to read. And whenever I do monthly blog posts, reviews of books about letters, and I find myself hallmarking against Guernsey every single month. Where I'm kind of, you know, one of the questions I ask is this a book about letters? Because I ask, is it a book about letters or is it a book that uses letters? Both of them are valuable and have different aspects to them. But in my definition, a book about letters is Guernsey.
And it's funny because traditionally those books don't do well. Like agents and author and editors will always try to dissuade authors from writing in that format because they say it's harder for the reader to connect. But like anything, I think it just depends on the quality of the writing. And it worked so well because the writing was so beautiful and the characters were so, you know, incredibly well drawn. The letters were actually a perfect foil for it. But traditionally, they're like, oh, don't write like that because it's really off-putting. It's harder to connect. But I think that's doing readers a disservice because I think if it's amazing writing, readers will connect with it, whatever.
Okay. They'll find whatever form it's in, but I it's interesting you say that because one of the things that I often find when I read books about letters is there's a very clear delineation about books that have letters in them and then books that use letters I have a degree in English, so I get into this, but books that have letters as a tool of exposition. And I think when you have letters as a tool of exposition that become plot heavy, you're kind of sitting there and you're like, Jesus, this is 18 pages of them describing a beach. And you're sort of like, no one would do that long of you know, meaningful step. There are sometimes when I read books, like, because I do so much work with, you know, manual, physical, real letters, where I'll be like, listen, I've read thousands of letters. Nobody's putting in that specific level of detail.
Yeah. And do you know what? I guess because you study letters and you see them daily, you know, often, I think it's writing letters in novels is one of the hardest things to make it sound authentic and real, because most people write what they think a letter writer does, when in reality,
this is so up my alley.
Yeah, I find it absolutely fascinating. I've just put out from the bookshelf as you were doing that, this is one of my favorite books, Letters to the Lost by Iona Gray. Have you heard of her?
I've got it on my TBR.
Oh, Iona Gray is without doubt one of my most favorite writers, Irish lady, and she's just the most beautiful writer. The way she describes things, her prose. And she uses a lot of letters, but so naturally in this book. I would really read it. You'll just fly through.
Yeah, okay, I'll move it up.
Shuttle it up the file.
This is big. February spot, a flea market love letters book about letters. Is a big spot. There's a lot of letter talk.
There's a lot of letter talk going on here. I feel like you have a novel in you. I feel like you do. I feel like you've studied it. You're tempted?
Yeah, I've played with it before. I've thought before about doing a nonfiction. So the kind of interesting, yes, I would like to write, but the depth of the archive, I held back a lot of times because I wasn't really sure the legal of everything. This is a question a lot of people sometimes have. How does it work? I've been advised by third parties, and one of them was a third party that was very reputable from a partnership that I did. And they basically explained that because the letters are acquired through a third person, I am sort of like I'm free to publish them as I do. And what I do is, because I don't make any profit off of the project, I just put that everywhere on the site. Yeah. And I also am very transparent about the fact that if someone, you know, went on and saw personal letters of their grandmothers and they were like, oi, what's the deal? Yeah. First off, can I have those back? And can you take them off the internet? I would.
Of course you would do.
There are stories, and I would love to do something along a nonfiction line, I think, with Flea Market in the next few years. But just when you get to that level, then it becomes you have to track down the families and
all. I hear that, yeah. And that's a whole world of, you know, lost sleep and hard graft that maybe, you know, you might want to consider doing the line. But you know what I love about it, though, and I think there's a real gap in the market for this, is there are a lot of non-fiction books. I think there was one recently by a historian, Sebastian, I can't remember, he's very highbrow, letters, you know, important letters in history. And it's always from men, you know, political leaders and, you know, warlords and very important upper-class white men writing important upper-class white male letters. There's nothing in the normal social history, the hidden letters, you know, the women, the men, just writing about mundane stuff, you know, reacting to
it
as it unfolds. And I always think, like, history being viewed through their eyes is so much more personal and intense and poignant than all of these sort of very important people writing about sort of hallmarks of history. And I don't think there's been anything like that that documents those sorts of letters.
I think the thing about that you've hit on with sort of important people, in air quotes, writing letters, or who do we deem important, is these are the people who are studied and who, you know, were around the tables when D-Day was called and all that sort of stuff. But they weren't, you know, there's a perspective of being in the trenches. There's a perspective of being called up for service. There's a perspective of being the wife at home while this is happening. And I think there is a gap in that narrative because, you know, talking about the American and the UK and the Irish side of things, the Americans are the most, I don't want to say okay with the letters, but Americans are usually, like, most of my letters are American because they're easiest to find.
Sure.
Americans are usually pretty proactive about engaging with the letters. And I have a lot of, you know, Irish readers or even readers in the UK who would be kind of like, it's very personal. It's very personal things.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Like,
Yeah. And so, like, I think there's real interesting studies in the differences of those, but absolutely. I mean, anytime I get my hands on letters that are real perspectives, I gobble them up.
Yeah. I think it'd be so fascinating. I would love to read that book. I really would. I just, yeah. And you'd be such a perfect author, such a great advocate for that kind of letter as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I if I could fit a day between, Monday and Sunday, that's when I do it.
So let's start this with your oldest letter, because that's the one I'm really intrigued by. What's the date on that letter?
Kind of the oldest one would be 1876. I don't have it to hand, but what I do remember about it is that it is just the penmanship of it. They say handwriting is something that we're forgetting. That's very fair when you see this letter.
really, is it that?
Yeah, the script is just one thing, and an art piece on its own. You can understand why people study antique handwriting. And the kind of really interesting thing for me is that it is it's 100 years out from US independence. Wow. So when you think about kind of being able to hold, in 2020, I was holding letters from 1918, and that was wild to be like, oh, it's 102 years old. But then when I'm able to hold a letter from 1876, the perspective changes, and I think this is 100 years from 1776, which is obviously a big hallmark for American kids and American history. So it's just that letter is particularly, it's the oldest I have in the archive, and it's the closest, I think, to a really big moment.
Yeah, and it's something so fragile as well, isn't it? A piece of paper is so easily dispensed with, and yet it survived all that time. You think through the history it's lived through is astonishing. That's what I love about the wide scope of the age of those letters. Where did you find it?
So a lot of those kind of oldest letters came from flea markets on the East Coast. The first collection of letters I had are from the 1920s, and I got those about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And letters after that were purchased kind of individually and sporadically. So I had one big collection, and then I would be out and I would see a couple letters and I'd get those. But it was only sort of when the archive started officially in 2017 that I started buying series as wholes. So a series is oftentimes, when I say series, I mean it's one sort of story. It could be five letters or it could be 55. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I frame things as series.
Okay, I'm with you. And so in this 1876 letter, who's writing it? Do we know, and what's he or she writing about?
Yeah, so it's mostly about farm details. So it's very simple. It's, it's as much as kind of what you might see today. You might throw out your receipt from Tesco and just be like, I don't need this. But, in 1876, they hand wrote everything. So we have these incredible records of farm accounts and all the sort of individual prices for things and that sort of stuff. So it's a time capsule is what it is.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I love the fact that, even mundane stuff that it's documenting, just the day-to-day stuff of life, is written in that beautiful cursive script and is like, so beautifully presented, whereas something we have lost that so completely, haven't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's your 1876. And then we're coming up to, so then we kind of thought, didn't we, the 1920s. And I think, let me just bring up your original. Which one had you suggested for the 1920s? Was it the Stocker family?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about them then. Tell me about these letters.
They're fun because those are an American family that in the 1920s, it was a mother, son, and father who went on a European tour. So this is right kind of between everything. I love the 1920s and the 1930s. I think they're
such interesting, complex.
They're
strange. Because anything interwar years is interesting though, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, you and I would absolutely get along. We could be here for 4 hours.
Oh my God. Just as well, we haven't got bottle of wine between. I wish we did have a bottle of wine and I was in Dublin having a drink with you, Chucky, because we'd be there all night.
We'd be there all night. You'd be like, oh, those women are still talking about beer.
We were saying how it's sort of underrated, the 1920s and 30s, because everybody gets to World War One and World War Two and it's sandwiched in between. It's sort of like the forgotten, sort of the ugly sister at the wedding, isn't it? But it's really
a very good way of putting it.
Interesting, complex, time of history. It was turbulent, wasn't it? I think, especially here in this country, with, like, you know, you think the abdication crisis and hunger marches on the streets, and
a lot of the so in that collection that I've highlighted, and all that is in there, photographs and letters and scans and anything, and that's all free game, kind of, if there's anything you pull of interest. The thing that's interesting about that is that they have photographs, and on this tour they went to, you know, I think they started in New York, and they kind of take a White Star so they take a White Star in the 1920s. That's pretty cool. I have White Star paper, White Star stationery.
Oh yeah, hello, just a bit.
As a history nerd, I'm like, woo!
I thought they pretty much went bankrupt after Titanic, but I'm guessing obviously not.
Well, they got to Lusitania. They survived the Lusitania.
Wow. Okay, they did, clearly.
Lots of tangents here, sorry. But the photographs that they have are really interesting, kind of, if you're thinking about Europe in that time of year or in that time of history. They have a lot of pictures of France, because they go around France and they go around the Netherlands. And obviously this is less than 5, 6, 7 years after World War II. So there are bayonets and crosses, and it's still very much, and World War I is referenced a lot in the letters. I mean, you have this family that's gone off on this great European trip, and they're talking about what sweaters they brought, but they're also sort of talking about, I think there's one letter where a mayor of a town in the Netherlands comes out, and they sort of, you know, there's a bunch of murmurs about how he behaved during the war, and you're just kind of like, oh, okay.
Oh, really? Well, like, as in collaboration, or, because I guess all those things would still be quite rife and quite raw in people's minds, wouldn't it? I mean, the war was like, what, 1920 to, was it 14 to 18? It would only been over 2 years.
I think the soccer letters are 24, so it's very close. It's very close. And that's that thing that I'm talking about, the tangibility of history. Yeah, I mean,
distance, isn't it?
It's so close. And then you're holding these photographs in your hand that are little, they're like sized business cards that were printed in 1920 something or other, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
But they're also talking about World War I that you think is so far away.
For them,
4 years before.
Yeah. I guess if you think of us now, we're in 2020, it's like discussing, you know, 4 years ago, it's so close. It's just history. So for them, for World War One, and also I guess when you think 1920, the Spanish flu, influenza, was going around the world at that point, wasn't it? I mean, so they were going through their pandemic at that time. Do they reference that at all anywhere, or is that?
Yeah. So I think it's the Bushnell letters, and if you're interested in that, come back to me and I'll find you a reference to it. But there's definitely references to the flu specifically. And it's sort of, it's not like that big Spanish flu epidemic. It's more like, gee, you know, a lot of my buddies are down with that flu, because that would have, from the US perspective, that would have been when a lot of the US was involved in World War One. So it would have been when a lot of boys basically were recruited. Mm. And they were basically brought to like training camps in Texas and California. And there was a COVID just running around the place. And so they were all put into quarantines, and there was no sanitation, there was no hygiene, there was no knowledge of what was going on. Yeah. So the World War One letters are where you'll most often find reference to a flu and things like that.
So with this, give it to the Stocker family, they must have been reasonably wealthy, I'm guessing, to travel the world on White Star at that point, you know, to have the affluence and the freedom to do that at that stage.
From what I have been able to kind of piece together from the letters, it was a gift. So it was a gifted trip from her father. Wow. So I believe her father was in some sort of, he was in a professor position somewhere in the Midwest of the US, and he gifted them this sort of European tour, as would have been, you're right, it was an affluent thing, but it was very much, if you're thinking kind of on the back of the Gilded Age, it was very much a thing that certain people of a status did, to go on these kind of month-long, very organized, stop in Switzerland, stop in France, stop in England sort of.
Yeah. So what's your favorite letter from that archive of the Stocker family? What detail did you find most interesting about that? I mean, it was, I haven't read all of them admittedly, but just some of them, I love the, just the mundanity of it, like what they have for breakfast, and, you know, how the continental breakfast, you know, and then in England you had porridge and all the rest of it. I really love that detail, because it just, you can totally relate to it.
And you can tell now that you know, kind of maybe that I've said, my understanding is that it was gifted. You can tell it's someone basically writing thank you letters. It's sort of someone who's gone on a thing, who's, you know, you've gone on a holiday that someone has, you know, given you a voucher for the hotel for, and you get to the hotel and you're like, the bed was very comfortable, but the next door neighbor snored and we could hear them through the wall, but the breakfast was delicious. And like, so like, yeah. it's a gratitude, but it's a everyday detail. It's, I love the soccer letters, but my favorite of them are the ones that are in, I think it's Lucerne. Right before COVID, I went back with photographs, and I took pictures of the photographs from the 1920s against landmarks that are still there. So I took it to the Lucerne Lion, and I took it to the bridge that's there, and I took pictures of them then and now. And that's something fun that I like to do when I can.
I love that.
Take them back.
What is it about that you get a thrill from? Like, why is it when you put yourself in their footsteps and you're standing in the place that they were or the letter was, how does that make you feel?
Oh, complete goosebumps. One of the series that I sent you about the 19 teens about World War One are the Jess and Best letters. And that's also the first time I ever went back to a place. So I went back to the house where those letters were sent. And that and visiting Switzerland were the two times that I've gone back to a place with a piece. And it gives you complete goosebumps. Like, you to stand on the porch of a house where a letter was delivered 100 years before that month is really, really eerie, but it's also very full. It's a full circle moment. You're sort of standing there and it washes through you.
Yeah, no, I could completely relate to that. Like, when I was writing the Little Wartime Library and I went down to Bethnal Green and found the spot where the library stood, and I'm standing there and it was really quiet because it was mid-pandemic. So there was nobody traveling on the underground. So for once I had the tube to myself and I was imagining what it was like, you know, trying to close my eyes and feeling my way into that, thinking, well, that track was boarded over. There was a library there. There was a theatre there.
Yeah.
People would have been singing there. It's really evocative. And I totally got that hairs up on the back of your neck, standing in the place where history, where for you feel that connection to that place is spine tingling, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think maybe you'll relate to this as well. It's not personal history for me. Like, it isn't it isn't my grandmother's letters. It isn't something. But I think it does kind of matter, because there are people who come to at least what Flea Market does, and they love it, right? And they get really into a story. They get into a series of letters, but then they'll say things like, and they'll be like, oh, but you know, I have my grandmother's letters, but I wouldn't do this with them. And I'm like, no, you wouldn't do this with them, but your grandmother's story is as much, you know, it's not the same as this person's that you've just really enjoyed. But I think there's a difference when it's a story that you identify with as a family versus as a collector or as someone who's come upon it. And one of the privileges I have is that because I'm not related to any of these people, I come into things completely blank. So I start a letter series, and I start a letter with letter one.
Yeah.
Letter one, and we go. And it can be stressful because there are things in these letters that are not nice. There are allusions to things. There are words and slurs and all sorts of stuff. And it kind of, every time you open a letter, you got to be ready for, okay, this is 1942. Where am I going?
I completely understand. And actually, maybe you're right. Maybe the fact that you're not personally related, you're coming to it as a clean slate almost, means you're in a stronger position, I suppose, to uncover the past.
I don't know, but I do know that it's different relationships if it's an inherited letter versus a collected or a found or acquired. I just think that I always say that everyone has a letter story, and that's why I do Flea Market. And I have my own family letter story that I don't talk about because that's our family letter story. But at the same time, that's a very personal thing for me, but I'm going around being like, you know, read this letter from 1925. So I have a very complex personal relationship with it, but the thing is just being, you know, if you feel an empathetic connection with something, you can really go miles with it.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think you have to have, you know, quite often people will say to me, why do you write about the East End when you're not from the East End? Well, I don't think that matters. If you have the connection, and that's the key, yeah, is empathy for it, yeah, and sometimes the love for it as well. You develop a real, so because this was going to say next, as you ask next, is who have you come across in your letter travels that you've really, mm-hmm, really made you laugh, or you really liked, and you thought, I'd love to know that person. And then B, maybe like someone who you just thought, oh, you're annoying or frustrating, or you're not particularly nice, you know, because you don't, just because something's in the past, we don't have to glamorize it, romanticize it. You know, there are annoying, pedantic, irritating people throughout history. But going back to the people that you really like or you related to, who are those?
I love this question. So the most recent series that comes to mind are the Roth letters. So they're from the 1930s. They're Kay and Nelda Roth. They're from Pennsylvania. They're an older couple, older being, you know, in the 1930s. They're in their mid-30s, I think. They don't have kids. She's hospitalized for some XYZ reason that's not known to us. But they exchange letters while she's in the hospital, and he visits her on the weekends, but they exchange letters during the week. And some of those letters, oh my gosh, we hit a spate with those letters where it was just every time I opened them, they were funny, they were romantic, they were, you know, okay. And then you'd type it up and you'd be like, they're gonna love you this week, Kay. And you'd be doing it that way. But it was so refreshing because it almost immediately followed, with a few gaps in between, a series that I kind of had to convince myself to keep doing, because it was that uncomfortable relationship with the person. Like, I'm not going to get on with every individual that writes these letters. So coming off of the back of kind of every week having to be like, here you go. To sort of like full on fall into this thing with Kay and Nelda and how sweet they were. And I was like, okay, here you go. This is good. This is good. We like this.
Yeah. Yeah. So with them, the Roth cover, what sort of phrases or lines stood out to you that you really thought, oh, you know, nobody A talks like that anymore, or that really, you know, sort of demonstrated the romanticism or the really beautiful use of language that people had,
yeah,
and were able to write back then. How did they, you know, rather than like now, if I was in hospital and texting my, I just text my husband, and we wouldn't go into the nitty gritty. But what were these letters revealing that when she was in hospital and he was at home?
She was, like I said, she was in hospital for some undisclosed reason. And I was never really able to parse what it was, but it seemed to be something associated with fatigue. And she mentions a lot that as she's in the sort of recovery or in the hospital, you know, a lot of her clothes are fitting better, her clothes are filling out. So I imagine, you know, she mentions fatigue and her diet and things like that. So I sort of picture her as maybe, you know, there was probably a lot going on that we don't know, but she might have been depressed, or there could have been any number of things, yeah, that would have sort of taken a toll physically. So she's obviously gone in for whatever treatments it is. But she's so funny. She talks about sort of like, I'm going to have to let out that yellow dress now because I've gotten so big in here. And it's like, it's 1940s big. So it's like a size two.
Probably size, yeah.
You're sitting there and you're like, oh, no, Nelda. Like, so that would be a time thing, but kind of the tenderness between them is they just have this really sweet way. Kay especially has this really sweet way of, even not being Nelda, I can read the letters and I can feel Kay there, because he's sort of like, he's updating her. They're building a house and he's updating her about the house. So he's saying, you know, this, I've done this, that, and the other. And then her next letter might be, oh, well, did you paint the banisters black or gray, and all that sort of thing. So it is very much sort of what you or I might text a partner or a husband, yeah, in print and all at once. So it is very much those mundane things, but it's just told differently than on a screen.
Yeah, I can see that. And then going into the ones where you said, but then you follow that up with ones that were, oh, quite difficult or sticky to read. Does that relate, yeah, to the ones from the 1940s where you were talking about the British war bride and the GI and her trying to find passage to America?
They're from the 1940s. So that series, Sandy and Harry, are the first letters that I ever did.
Okay.
So they are the sort of first, they started Flea Market, really. Kind of when I decided to start first I started posting pictures of the envelopes, and then I realized that people really wanted to see the letters that were inside. And then that's when I was like, oh, people want to see the letters, not just the physical letter. But so Sandy and Harry are separate from the other story before, were the Randano letters. So the Randano letters were, they took basically a year. There was like 170. They were all to this guy named Ralph Randano.
Wow.
And I think what I bristled the most about that was they were a lot of male perspective during World War II. And I think people come into flea market thinking that it's all very romantic, but there was also a very real side to it. And it was very guys talking to guys in a way that a woman in 2021 or 2022 might not like to read.
Okay. So was it between two men or was it these?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Oh, how interesting. So what were they, what bristled you? What were they saying that made you?
Mostly the way they, I can't speak for them because they're 70 years old letters, 100 years old in some cases, but just kind of, you know, the way they go back and forth about girls they were seeing. There was one instance where I very rarely exclude things from letters, but there was one instance where someone wrote to someone else with very specific details of how to find the house of a very friendly lady.
Oh, really?
And I was like, I'm going to stand up for her and I'm not going to put this in there.
Oh, that is horrible. But, you know, why wouldn't it happen in the 19th? Of course it would have happened then. Like it has throughout history. Why? Yeah.
That's the thing. And that's what Flea Market kind of forces me to do on the daily. And what I try and get people to interrogate is that history is not all of these. There are these great fluffy love stories, but then there are also instances where you have to tackle slurs and references to things. There's a lot of times where I end up feeling like I have to put a disclaimer on stuff to kind of explain that what you're about to read was written in XYZ year. Yeah,
it's not obvious. And that's just what it is. Racism and misogyny and, you know, all of those inbuilt things were rife, weren't they? Of course.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. So tell me about the War Bride couple, because I'm fascinated by that whole thing. Like I interviewed this incredible lady recently who lives in, where does she live? She lives in Seattle now, but she was a War Bride. They were a very like romantic couple. They met at a dance. He was working for US military intelligence, like an outpost of Bletchley. And she was just telling me the whole logistics of, like, you know, the whole thing of how the American war brides actually managed to get out there. It took them years and they had to campaign and they were treated as second class citizens, and her passage alone took something like 6 to 7 weeks to sail, and then the boat started to kind of break apart when they got to New York, and it was just grueling, you know, the whole trip. And she was telling me all about it, and I thought, my God, it's so far removed from what we think, you know, the dream was for these you know, the Wallflower Brides, I think they called them in the end. But yeah, incredible stories. So
and oftentimes they hadn't even heard from the guys they were heading to marry in 2 months.
I mean, talk about a leap of faith, you know, like packing up your whole world and knowing you probably wouldn't see your family again. For what? And all on the say so of a guy you might have met once or a few times at a dance who told you he was this thing or that thing, but in reality often ended up not being that way at all. So
I was explaining to someone, I had to explain what a war bride was to someone today, and I end up having to do a lot of kind of explaining what random very niche stuff, I feel like you do this as well, what very niche stuff in history is, where you just roll something off and then someone's like, hold up, wait, what?
That's a war bride. I know, because the name alone is quite startling, isn't it?
And so then you're like, oh, you're not in this world, let me slow down and explain this. So just to know somebody who kind of knows and is already describing a very similar story to what Harry and Sandy had, I'm like,
yeah, we could talk about this for hours. But yeah, so what was their story then? How did they presumably, she was British, do you know where they met?
So I have all the original letters, so we can go through and kind of get the details from the envelopes and the letters and things, because I won't bastardize it by being like, I don't know London. I'm American, but I'm not that American. But what I do know is that he was in New Jersey, and I have two sets of letters. So I have letters from the 1940s and letters from the 1950s when she goes back for a summer. And she brings their two daughters back in the 1950s, and she stays with her mother, who she obviously hasn't seen since whatever the tail end of that 40 year is that she emigrates to move in with him. But the fascinating thing that I picked up on your story that mirrors Sandy and Harry, a lot of her letters to him are very detail specific. So they might be like, I need that form because the boat leaves on the 7th. And if I don't have that form from you by the 7th, I won't be able to get that boat to get to the next. And then like 2 weeks later, it might be, well, I missed the one on the 7th.
Oh, you just think about the logistical nightmare of all of that, that everything had to go through. Like, you know, whereas now we just click and we're there. But for them,
that's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Laborious and bureaucratic and fraught. And you think how many relationships turned on, you know, lived or died by these things.
Yeah.
On paper.
And you're thinking as well, I mean, there's parts in the letters where she talks about, I mean, maybe she was in London, because I think she talks about Blitz, about rubble from the Blitz or rubble from a bombing. And like, when you're thinking as well, it's post-war, it's immediately post-war. Communications are spotty at best. So, you know, getting a letter up and down the road is one thing, but getting back and forth from New Jersey in time to get a form. Yeah. To get on a boat is very different.
It's a miracle they even ended up together at all, really, isn't it? Given the hardships and the enormity of the difficulty of just trying to be together under that circumstance.
Oh, Sandy's spunky. I don't think Sandy would have taken no for an answer. I think Sandy saw, you know, I can't speak to true love and all those sort of things, but I think Sandy saw
a good life
what that was.
Yeah,
it was a completely different life, and it was after years of what she had endured.
Yeah,
and I think she just, you know, she was a great series to start with.
Yeah,
she was very much like Sandy's very much a core flea market.
She was kind of this, wasn't she? But you know, I think that perception wasn't there, particularly like for English women who've come through the rubble and the Blitz and the bombing and the rationing and everything's grey and streets are pockmarked with bombs, and then suddenly they've had these glamorous, incredible GIs that have been sweeping them, you know, who are larger than life and colorful. Of course they're going to want a better life for themselves. It was about, you know, they wanted to better themselves. So yeah, you can see why she stuck to her guns and got out there. Who's your favorite woman that you've come across in all of these letters, who stands out to you as somebody like, oh, I'd love to go for a drink with you, or I'd love to just sit down with you?
Probably 40s Sandy. I think 40s Sandy is the one I would hang out with. She's funny. She talks at one point, Sandy's great. She talks at one point about, I think it's Sandy. I'm sure it's Sandy about kind of how like lecherous her boss is. I remember she's sort of saying how like, you know, he gives her the eye, and there's like a pool of secretaries, if I remember, and they all call Harry's pictures on the wall, and I think they all call him like Hubba Hubba. I was trying to search keywords that I remembered from this for you. They're in those early 40s letters, so I know they're in there somewhere. But she has a real jargon, she has a real spunk, and she gets up in there. But there are a lot of really strong women that are in the archive. There's letters from the Great Depression, wives who have kept entire homes running while husbands have gone all over the Midwest of the US to work to send money home, $2-3 at a time during the Great Depression. There are mothers whose sons have gone off to World War II. Because the archive isn't just spouses and girlfriends and boyfriends, it is love letters generally. So there's family letters, there's friend letters. But yeah, I would say kind of, you know, if I had to hang out with someone, it would probably be Sandy. But she might just talk my ear off about how she can't get Harry to send her the right forms.
Yes, you're right. But I don't know. I like anyone that says hubba bubba about a guy and sets her storyline and goes for it. It's got to be all right in my book. So you never know when you pick up a letter what it's going to be. Like, and you can't, and they're very difficult to tell straight away, isn't it? Whether it is a love letter or whether it's a friendship or a family or what sort of correspondence it is. What you say, the majority of them are love letters. Is that the case then, that it is mostly husbands, wives, sweethearts, that sort of thing?
Recently, yes. So what I mean by recently is all of the letters are, when I acquire letters, they're usually loose. And then I will initially kind of, if I get, let's say, a Ziploc bag full of letters, I will put them in just immediately into binder sleeves. I don't really put them into chronological order or read them or photograph or do anything. I just put them away and I catalog them. I have a system kind of, you know, the binder goes into a spreadsheet and there it is. And I know it's okay, 1928 to 1932, kind of that's how it is. So when it comes up to time to be in, to pick a new series, I'll look at the spreadsheet or I'll look at the binders and I'll kind of feel drawn to one to pull out.
Okay.
And then that's when I start to really read what the letters are. So then I might take them out and they might be all over the place, jumbled. Then I put them into chronological order. Then I photograph them each individually. Then I put them back into chronological order in the binders, and then I start transcribing. So after I transcribe, I put on the website and then I post on social.
Yeah. So you've done about 300 of these, but you must have many more still to go then, presumably.
Yeah, last count, it was about 1600 yet to go, I think, last count.
Wow, that's a lot of work ahead.
A lot of years of letters, don't worry.
A lot of years of letters. And this might be a question that you might need to answer on email, but one of the things I love about looking into the archives in the past is some of those words or phrases that you just simply don't hear anymore in everyday language. And I wonder if there are any that you stuck in your mind that you think, oh, we need to resurrect that phrase or that word and bring that back. Because there is so much, and that's what's great about these letters, is that it really reveals the richness and the vibrancy of all those beautiful phrases. Anything sticks in your mind, or do you need to have a think about that and email me some?
I'll have a think. I'll look tonight. What I do, I don't know if you've seen on the Instagram, but what I do is I pull quotes. So I'll have a look through some of the pull quotes.
And I've been a lot of those as well, actually. And yeah, and just seeing what's...
Oh, don't worry about it. You'll pass a lot of pictures and letters to get to quotes. So do what you like, but I'll have a look, and if there's any that come to mind. But yeah, there's that's kind of the easiest way for outstanding quotes. As I'm going, I tend to pull them out. So I'll see if there are any dazzlers in there for you.
Fabulous. And lastly, and I will let you go because I know your mom's waiting, and any moment now someone's going to come crashing through the door. When you've been posting these things on Instagram and Facebook and so forth, who are which eras, I suppose, that people gravitate towards mostly? Is it the conflict in the World War I and World War II? Mm. Or what do people tend to, you get a feel for who people connect to or what era people connect to? What would you say?
World War II.
Yeah. Why is that, do you suppose? I mean, it's just, there are so many reasons, I guess, isn't there? It's, you know, but I feel like from our perspective here in England, it's a lot of it is to do with, I think that there's this perception it was our finest era, and a lot of the propaganda still prevails today.
Mm. But I would say that's very similar to US as well. I mean, you had Hollywood, you had I think that younger generations, being anyone that kind of isn't a first generation to a child of World War I or to someone who was active in World War I, let's say, so baby boom and beyond. I think if you are even one generation removed from it, there's this inborn patriotism that is like the thing that you know about. Mm. Even if you don't really know history, you know World War II happened. Yeah. And I think it's the nearest, it's the safest place that I think a lot of films will go for historical fiction. So a lot of films will kind of go into that world. So like starting where we end, ending where we started off, The Notebook. The Notebook is World War II written all over it. Yeah. And so I feel like people see that, and then they have this kind of very romantic idea of patriotism and masculinity and the woman at home and the woman's contribution to the war front. In the US, we had a very different relationship with the war than would have happened in the UK, because you guys were being bombed and we weren't, but we were rationing and sacrificing to send over to soldiers. So like, there's so many differences, but at the same time, it's the scarcity and the sort of the knitting together of all that. Mm-hmm. So I would say, I mean, I'm spoiled for kind of saying, oh, I love the ones from the 1920s and the 30s. But I love all of them. I have all of them. I'll keep them for as long as I'm in charge of them. But people love World War II.
Yeah, they do. They do. It's so true. You know, I wrote a book set in the 1930s and it just bombed. You know, like, it just, no, nobody was interested. For me, it was fascinating because it was all set during the time when there's the rise of the far right and fascism, and you know, people were marching in the streets, the black shirts, and you could see that, you know, nobody knew that war was on the horizon, but there was this great rise of the far right and fascism. So I thought that's really, really interesting. And I'm really interested. Lots of other people would be really interested in it, but no, not so. And it, unless it doesn't have explicit signposting on the front, like with the Spitfire and War somewhere written on it, it just doesn't seem to engage.
Doesn't spark.
So it shows that something really deeply ingrained within us that relates to that story, the story of World War II and our relationship to it, and how, what we tell ourselves about it. And I guess because everybody, and it would be the same in America, everybody has a war story of some sort, or a narrative that they're in their head, like, you know, my grandfather did this or grandmother did that, or this was when we were great. And
I think there's also sort of like, if you want to get a little bit psychological about it, I think that there's like just a fixation with youth related to World War II. I think there's a lot of it's, you know, the young plucky heroine who goes and leaves home, and she's a duchess, and then she like, she becomes a nurse in France, and it's like, it's just a real like young persons.
And everybody was glamorous and handsome, and you know, the men all had pants, and the women had carmine lips, and you know, and they had no money, but they still managed to look incredible. And
and the only mention to prehistory is that the general, he fought in the last war. Like, that's usually the like oldest, wisest character is always a great war veteran, and you're like, okay, but he was 18 in that one, can we go there?
Yeah, you're right. World War One again, and maybe it's because it's just got that distance of years, but and I suppose it was much more jingoistic, wasn't it? Everybody sort of marched off to war, and then there was this dreadful slaughter, you know, whereas by the Second World War, our attitudes had changed towards it. But yeah, you're right. Again, World War One, it sort of feels to some people like a diluted war, that they're not as, it's too distant, and they can't relate to it in some way. Oh my God, it's so fascinating. I have so many questions for you. And I haven't been anywhere near the space.
Do you have any idea what a dream it is for someone who reads like categorically probably 50 historical fiction books a year to talk to someone who, first off, does them, second off, understands, third off, is like, yeah, that's a valid point. I'm beaming.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.